Tonight, we're going to be in the book of Judges, so if you would take your Bibles, turn there, and we'll be looking at Judges chapter 17. Lord willing, we are going to be done with this study at the very end of the month of October. So I think there's, four more Wednesdays? I can't remember. Three more, Ken is saying. I'll trust the mathematician in our midst here. So again, we're looking at three more messages to finish out this book of the Judges. Now, does anybody recognize the name General Joseph Stilwell? You might be thinking, oh no, another Civil War general. No, he wasn't a Civil War general. He served in the U.S. Army over in China from the years 1911 to 1945. 34 years. He went over during the year of the Chinese Rebellion. That is when he went into China. And he served as the, if you want to think of it as the territorial commander of U.S. forces in China during World War II. And in between there, he was involved in many different ways with the Chinese government. Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. He personally knew him. Now, the two of them really didn't get along very well, but FDR actually personally assigned Stilwell to the Chinese theater and essentially pleaded with Chiang Kai-shek that he cooperate and work with Stilwell, because FDR realized that if China falls to Japan, Japan has a major amount of property now over in, basically they have the entire Far East. From Japan almost all the way to India, they would own. China was the last free territory that stood between Japan and the complete conquering of the Far East. And Stilwell, again, was that general. Now, again, and General Stilwell had been given the moniker of Vinegar Joe. Now, if you've ever tasted raw vinegar, what sort of reaction does your face have? Yeah, Jonathan's giving it to me right now. It's not pleasant. But again, he was given that nickname of Vinegar Joe, General Vinegar Joe Stilwell. And more than likely, from what I've read of the man, I've not read a whole lot. I'm actually reading a biography about him. That it may have been something as a matter of pride when he was called that, because he did. A lot of people said he was a man that spewed acid a lot of times when he dealt with people. But he was an effective man in what he did, and he understood the Chinese people. Well, there again, as I said, he ended his service over in China in 1945, and he was asked to write to the graduating class of West Point that year in 1945. And one of the statements that he said in his written address to them was this. He said, "You will hear a lot of talk about how this or that generation messed things up and whatever else in the war. What nonsense. All living generations are responsible for what we do, and all dead ones as well." Now, you might think, well, what in the world does that have to do with anything? Well, I found and I thought that quote has a lot to say regarding the book of Judges. We have looked from chapters 1 through 16 at the book of Judges, almost the people of Israel collectively. We might tend to forget that the collective is made up of the ones, the individuals. Again, you can't have a collective unless you have individuals in that collective. And what we see is here, starting in chapter 17 through the end of the book, there's more of a focus on individualism in these last chapters than there has been before. Now, you might say, well, what about all the judges? Yes, we understand that there were, as it were, spotlights biblically on these individuals called the judges, but the picture was not just of them and primarily of them. It was a bigger view, a God view of all of the people of Israel and the need for judges. And we come to this chapter 17, and probably most of you in here have heard it said before, maybe preached before, read it in devotionals or commentaries. When it comes to verse number 6, and we see this repeated a few times actually, in once in chapter 18 and then in the final chapter of this book. But we see this statement: in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Again, if you look at chapter 18, verse 1, in those days there was no king in Israel. There's a tie to that statement. And I, for one, I have preached this before. I believed it before, where I used to say, well, that's the theme of the book. I don't believe that anymore. It's the theme of the end of the book. Because this book of Judges really has multiple themes, and what we see overall is really a book that talks about spiritual declension. Where if we were to say it, if we wanted to pick a theme, we could pick the theme of what is stated far more than that statement of the people did what was right in their own eyes, was that the people again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. That's spiritual declension. We see that over and over and over again. And again, another theme, as I brought up last week, is the subject of the Spirit of the Lord. Again, Jephthah, Samson, Gideon, Othniel, it's said of these men that the Spirit of the Lord moved upon them. And I thought it fascinating, and I can't remember if I mentioned this, but out of the entire Old Testament, that statement is stated more here in the book of Judges than elsewhere. It's said of David that the Spirit of the Lord moved upon him. It's said of Ezekiel as well. But in concentrated form, it's said more in the book of Judges. So we can see that is almost a sub-theme here, is spiritual declension, but also the activity of the Spirit of God. But then when we come to the end of the book, from chapter 17 on, we're seeing this repeated statement of there was no king in Israel, there was no king in Israel, there was no king in Israel. And then we have it stated twice, like it says there in verse number 6, and every man did which was right in his own eyes. And what we're going to have in chapter 17 and 18, and even into chapter 19, we're going to see that fleshed out. That in this time, there was no king. Now, in a sense, the judges were in the place of kings. And we read of Abimelech as well, who was set up as a king, just in a small tribal sense, not over the entire body of the 12 tribes. But again, there was this idea of rulership. But after Samson passed off the scene, there was this span in which there was no one that God raised up. And again, they were, as it were, leaderless. It wasn't until the time that we mentioned regarding Samuel, who was a judge after Eli, that we see the people crying out for what? A king, just like the people around them had, the Canaanites. Those Canaanites were still there. And the Jews were very familiar with the fact they had kings over them. Well, we want the same thing. Because again, number one, they felt like they were defenseless. They saw themselves as basically scattered and leaderless. So guess what? Give us a king, we'll follow this man. So again, this is what this period of the judges that we're talking about is dealing with. That there was no ruler or leader in these days. What days? Chapter 17 and on. And so what was the result of that? How does that leaderlessness flesh itself out? Well, we come to this chapter 17 and we see literally, and it's not a long chapter, but we see this major, major problem that the Jews had been dealing with since the time they left Egypt, and that is the subject of idolatry. Idolatry. Now again, for all of those that grew up in Sunday school classes or vacation Bible school, what's the big story about idolatry that you were always shown on either the flannel graphs or maybe overhead the slide things, overhead projectors? What was the big story of idolatry in the Old Testament that almost bar none every teacher went to? Okay, Daniel, I'm thinking of one other, though, long before Daniel. Golden calf, okay? But Daniel is a good picture because, again, we see what idolatry we can understand. The Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Persians, all of these people. We understand that they had idolatry in their midst. Why? They did not know the living God. But yet the Jews knew the living God. And what did they do anyway? They forsook him and practiced idolatry. And again, we're almost looking at it when we go back to Moses and we see that idolatry there in the book of Exodus. It's like they're on the back steps of Egypt and they practice this almost immediately. They're freshly out of the land. They'd heard the Ten Commandments given to them by the voice of God. They'd seen the smoke, they'd seen the fire, the lightning, they heard the thunderings, they felt the earthquake, they heard the voice of God, so on and so forth. And yet, what do? When Moses is gone longer than what they would like, Aaron, Moses' brother, produces a golden calf. And they begin to worship it. And and it's amazing. What does Aaron say? What does he tell the people that this golden calf is? This is your God. This is Jehovah. So we see again, and we all know the results of that. But throughout the history of the people of Israel, they've had a problem with idolatry. Again, beyond the book of Judges, they had a problem with idolatry. You see it in the kings, again, going to the exile. It was as if they were exposed, inundated, and bathed in idolatry. And it wasn't until after the exile that they seemed to be cured. And I think Pastor Gray was the one that referenced this recently, that the Jews seem to have learned a lesson regarding idolatry when they came back from Babylon. You see a strengthening of a monotheistic culture then, rather than a polytheistic culture. You remember a few chapters back when we looked at in Judges, where in one verse alone, it was like seven different idols or gods that these people bowed down to. And God said, I'm done with you. You can come to me all you want. I will not hear you anymore. So again, idolatry. It's not just a collective problem. As I said to begin with, the collective is made up of individuals. And so when we come to Judges 17, we're almost having it to where God is taking an example out of the midst of all of the people possible and saying, let me give you a description of what it looks like to be a spiritually leaderless group of people. Again, as we read of Paul saying, these things were written for us, the Old Testament stories were written for our instruction and elsewhere for our admonition. That why? So we would not repeat the same sin mistakes that these people did. And one of them was idolatry. And we read about Micah. This man, we don't know much about him other than the fact, as it says in verse 1, he was a man from the mountains of Ephraim, northern section of the tribes. Here's this man, Micah. And we know he's a thief. We're not starting out pretty good here. Here's a man that had stolen a small fortune. From whom? His mother. Now, we've all heard stories about kids stealing money out of their mother's purses or their father's wallet. And again, it shocks us and surprises us because it's not something that is the norm. It stands out as high. You don't typically steal from intimate family members. But yet Micah was guilty of it. And his mother, not knowing that it was him, what did she do? Well, she essentially called down a curse on whoever it was that stole. Well, guess what? He heard this. And probably out of either fear, I don't know, maybe a guilty conscience, he comes to her and says, Mom, I'm the one that stole it. Now, you might think, okay, this is some 17-year-old little twerp that's done this type of thing. No. Because we read later on, Micah was a full-grown man that had a family of his own. He had children. Now, some people gather that it was probably a measure of an inheritance that he expected at some time, that he may have reasoned in his mind that, well, it's going to be mine anyway. I'm just going to take it now, but I'm not going to let mom know. Well, again, worse comes to worse. He hears this curse. And rather than herself being angry, we again read there in verse 2 that she literally says, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." It's like there was a relief that was there, because it wasn't some stranger that took the money. It was her own child. And so rather than again holding to what she called God to do to him, the thief, she turns it around and says, "Well, since it's you, I'm going to ask God to bless you." And what happens as a result of that? She says, "Well, I was going to give it to you anyway." So she takes 200 shekels of this money of 1,000 and does what? She goes and takes it to a silversmith and has him frame it into an idol. So now, what does the man do? Verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine made in ephod and household idols. Teraphim is the King James word there. And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. And then we have verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, these people obviously knew somewhat of the old covenant. They knew, because again, they used the covenant name of God back there in verse number 2, the mother does, where she says, "May you be blessed by the Lord." That's Yahweh. That's the name of God from Exodus chapter 3 and 4. So there was some knowledge of the Lord. I don't know if it was a saving knowledge. By the way, I look at these things, and I suspect not. But again, we're not given further detail. There would have been knowledge of a covenant, though, because this was ingrained in the society of the people since the time they had come out of Egypt. And this is hundreds of years later. If you do a tallying of just the numbers of years that the judges ruled, it's 400, if I remember right, it's 420 some years in total. And this is after Samson. So there's a spread between, again, the conquest with Joshua and the ending of Samson. But there was still an understanding of covenant relationship. Why? Because what we read there in verse number 5, he made a shrine and an ephod and, again, teraphim, or the household idols. There was a recognition of worship of the Lord. And again, as we saw, this one would set up a priesthood. He consecrated one of his own sons. Now, what's the problem with that? He had no right to do that. Now, again, probably a fairly well-to-do guy. If you're making idols out of silver, you're well off. Step above that would be gold. But he's got an idol of silver, and he takes it upon himself to establish a priesthood with one of his own sons to lead the family in worship. But then we're told in verse number 7, there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, southern section of what would one day be the nation of Israel, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite. Guess what? There's a marker. We read of a Levite. Now, what were they? They were that priestly class. They were the ones set aside by God to perform the functions of the tabernacle and then later the temple. And here comes this young man, and it says there that he was a Levite, and here he departs from Jerusalem, or from Bethlehem in Judah, and guess where he lands? Up in the mountains of Ephraim, where Micah and his family live. And Micah recognizes again that this is somebody that's not from around there, and he asks him, "Where are you from?" And he says, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah," down in verse number 9. and I'm basically trying to find a place to stay. Guess what? Something better than me consecrating one of my own sons is a man I know is definitely consecrated by God. He's a Levite. And so we read, again, in short story, he has this man come onto his staff, so to speak, and says, I want you to come here. I'll be a father to you. I want you to be a priest to me. I'll give you, as it says, 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothing, and your sustenance. In other words, you have free room and board, and I'm going to give you some extra amenities on the side as well. What better could you ask than that? You're going to be taken care of. You don't need to worry about a thing. And what does the young man do? Humanly speaking, he does what probably anybody that would be unsaved would do. That sounds like a good deal. It's never been easy to live in an agricultural society, folks. And now here is this man, during a time when there was no king in Israel, that's a Levite, and what does he become? He becomes the household priest of an idolater. You might say, well, maybe he's gonna change these people. They'll be transformed. They'll be revived. They'll be saved. But not so. Because when you read there, it says in verse 12, Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest, lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as a priest. It's not until we get to the next chapter, which we don't have time to go into tonight, that we see this young man, this Levite, actually uses the idol that Micah's mother had framed in worshiping God. So now we have a man and his family who are idolaters, and we also have a Levite who knew better, who violates God's clear commandment of not making anything that's supposed to represent him. This is the picture, dear ones, of what we see in a land that rejects God. Now, and again, we heard it tonight. Prayer requests regarding our nation and all that's going on. And I'm in full agreement with Pastor Gray. My wife and I, we were talking about this just yesterday. We were on our way to an appointment, and I said, I was looking back, and I mean, I'll glance at news articles, but I very rarely read from top to bottom. I don't think I have sat down to watch the news on TV or on the internet in almost 2 years. Because, and my wife and I were talking about this, I don't know if any of you heard, probably some of you did, about the man that was shot and died over in the parking lot at CVS right off the corner of the school, just not far from where my family and I live. They assume it's some drug-related gang activity that the guy was shot, and he literally died in the parking lot there on the corner of East North Street and 291. And when you turn on the news, local, what do you hear? Death, suicide, car wrecks. One right after the other. And I thought, you know, what does the news thrive on? It thrives on misery. And the bigger, the better. I look at that and say, I don't really have much to do with that type of thing. I don't want to have anything to do with that. And yet we see that this is not something uncommon even amongst those who are called the people of God. That they live however they want when God is not in the picture. What does this all say here now to wrap this up tonight? I got a couple of minutes left. What's the point of all that? Well, the point is this, dear ones, don't reject the Lord. It's really, there's one choice. You have two options, one choice. Either follow God or follow your own heart's desires. And again, God with this book of Judges has been showing over and over and over again what the result of following your own desires will be. Next chapter, again in chapter 18, which we'll go into in a little bit more detail than what we've done tonight with chapter 17, we'll see again this idea of idolatry continued to where, again, it ends in ruin all the time. Why? Because it was meant to. God will not allow His covenant people to continue going on, forsaking Him, forgetting about Him. And what I mean by forgetting is not, well, He just slipped our mind. It's a willful negligence that leads to no longer having God in your thoughts and in your life. And God puts this one book, Judges, right in the midst of the Old Testament to say, you know what? This is how bad it can get when you live in amongst a people that do not know the Lord. And may I say it, dear ones, lovingly, we are almost, if not right there ourselves in this country. There were some people, I don't know for what anti-abortion organization, but they had some signs off campus today. And again, it reminded me again, we live in a society since 1973 that has desired and our Supreme Court legalized or upheld constitutionally the legalization of the murder. And if I remember, the last number I saw was over 63 million people. Now, we don't like to think this way, but you know what? Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin have nothing compared to the United States of America. Not at all. Now, what they did, it was horrendous. It was demonic. It was of the devil. And may I say it, our country is right there with them. Why? We live in the midst of a people who have forgotten God and they want their own way. That's Judges. It's Judges. Now, you've seen how this book has been in some small measure graphic. When you come to chapter 19, I think it is one of the worst chapters graphically in all of the scripture as far how far downhill people can go when their heart is not set on doing what is right before the Lord. Where we have an actual guy that takes his wife and cuts her up, her body, and sends it to the 12 tribes to rally them to pay back a group of people that did him wrong. I mean, you think of, you don't see horror shows that have that type of stuff go on. And yet God makes it known, and I love this about our Lord. He does not sugarcoat anything. He makes it known this is how bad the human heart is. It will take an object that was loved and adored and actually make it horrible and send it out to people. A people without God. Now, thankfully, we have a group that's here tonight and all over the United States and all over the world for that matter. We have believers that are scattered throughout this globe. But dear ones, when you think about it, we are in the minority, definitely. Mm-hmm. When you see and hear and discuss what's taking place, you almost wonder, how is it God has so much patience with us, but aren't you thankful He does? We have a God who loves us, who shows mercy to us, who is long-suffering even toward the wicked, who cares for them even though they hate Him. And yet, one day, His justice will be met. If they've not come to Christ and met His justice and mercy there, they will meet His justice as they stand before Him. God will not allow the sin of the world to continue going on forever. There is a final day. We don't know when that will be, but there is a final day of reckoning that men and women will answer to the Lord. And again, as we see here, we have an impetus to go before our God and beg Him, show mercy to this land. Because apart from You, God, there is no hope. No hope at all.